Growth is this iterative, data-driven process of using what's essentially the scientific method to move a metric. The most foundational rule for growth is, I would say, it's that retention is more important than acquisition. And engagement is super highly correlated with retention, as you can imagine. They're two sides of the same coin, really. It's pretty rare that a highly engaged person is not retained. Your retention rates will be the limiting factor for your growth, not your acquisition rates. The best way to drive growth is to focus on the user value, not a metric that you care about, but they could care less about.
If you're measuring the outcomes, it generally forces people to take fewer risks.
You have to be trying some big things that are going to be big swings. Whether it's a big swing or a smaller experiment, the only time it's a real failure is if we didn't learn anything from it.
Hey Ken, welcome to the Effortless Podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so I mean, your career reads like the roadmap of a modern tech's greatest growth stories. You pioneered the data driven practices at Zynga. You built the first analytics team at Facebook. You led growth over there. Then you went to Google and led growth over there. And then, of course, you and I got to work together at ThoughtSpot, where you transformed the company from purely sales-led growth to a hybrid product-led and sales-led growth. I personally learned so much from you. So let's get
Thank you for the
started.
kind words. I'm very grateful for the luck I've had in my career. I've been really just fortunate, so.
So let's maybe start here. So if you look back from your career all the way to Zynga, Facebook, Google, and ThoughtSpot, what's the moment that inspires you the most where you kind of looked at it and said, wow, this was something amazing that we did here?
I've been doing growth for 15 years or so. And I got into it mostly because it was a great combination of analytics and product work, which I love both. And it was a great combination of those. But if I think about something that for me is can capture like the essence, my favorite story, my favorite experience is when I was at Google. And the context here is when I started at Google, the first thing I focused on was how do we grow Google search? And Google had something like 90% plus of all the search traffic in the world at the time. And everyone who was searching, 90% were using Google. So growth was less about how do we get more people to use Google because everyone already was. It was how do we get people to use Google more? So we were focusing on how do we increase engagement? And we did some analysis to get started. And we looked at what is the average user. We focused on the US initially. What is the average user in the US? What's their engagement level in terms of how many searches per month they did for Google? And by the way, do you have a guess on that? I was completely wrong on this. Do you have a guess on what that might have been? This is a decade ago.
How many searches does a
Per
person do on
month.
Google per
Yeah.
month? My guess would be somewhere between 100 and 200.
I guessed 150, so right in the middle there. The answer was 12. So we saw that there was a huge opportunity here to see if we could grow that. And we started looking at there's quite a difference between the average And then a significant group who did well over 100, several hundred a month. And when we looked at fundamentally doing the analysis of what the difference was, it was how many what we ended up calling knowledge domains they were searching across. And a knowledge domain is like reference information, news, shopping, cooking, sports, travel. And what we found was the people who were doing a small number were really only familiar with and really only using one of those domains, for example. And the people who were doing hundreds were doing searches across many of these domains. So that was our first insight was if we can get them to use these other features that most people aren't even aware about, they're not even using at all. We looked at which one of those domains was the stickiest, meaning the people who used it continued to use it frequently. And it turned out it was in the area of sports and specifically in the area of sports scores. We found that anyone who did a search on sports scores was very likely to do another one at least once a month. But only 15% of people had ever done a sports score. So there's a big opportunity there. If we could get the other 85 to do it, we could drive some engagement there. So I went to the team that was in charge of the sports knowledge domain. They'd already built sports score information for all the major sports: football, baseball, basketball, cricket, hockey, soccer, tennis, and so on. And the mindset there was to drive engagement, we need more features. That's how you get more people to use it. You add more things. So they already had all of the main sports. And when I looked at their roadmap, the two items that had been planned for the next quarter were ping pong, or I guess more accurately, table tennis and sumo wrestling. Now, ping pong, very big sport, but big in China. And we were at the time mostly banned in China. And sumo wrestling, apologies in advance if you happen to be a huge fan, but it's a pretty niche sport. So the suggestion was, wait, why are we doing that? Why don't we try and get people to use the two most popular sports in the world, which were soccer and cricket? And so that was the focus. It wasn't about building something new. It was about getting people to use what we already had. And so some of the product changes we made were instead of just a blank search box, this is kind of when we introduced having that light gray text in the search box with a recommended search. And it would recommend different knowledge domains that you had never searched for before. And so it was just a way to nudge people about what else Google search could do. And then another thing we did was what we called chaining. When you did a search for something that was related to sports, like you would do a reference search on the history of some famous athlete. At the bottom of that, we would suggest additional searches, and one would be, would you like to see the sports scores of the team this athlete is on? And there were several other things, but we were able to do things like that. And we were able to double the amount of people who were searching for sports information and sports scores within about 6 months. And what I love about this, and why I think it's such a great example for me to always remember, is it combined both analytics and product work, which I mentioned that I love. And we were able to drive really significant growth by focusing on what we already had. We just got more people to use it. We've removed the barrier of, I didn't even know you had that. So that sticks with me.
Very cool. Very cool. I guess we got into it very fast. Maybe what would be helpful for our listeners is to define how do you define growth as a function in any company, and what are their goals, and how does it work with other teams?
So I think the example I just shared is a good example of what a growth team would work on. The way I define growth, and I'll focus on it for the product. There's also how growth applies to marketing. It's very, very similar. But when you're talking about growth, and if we're thinking about it from how does it apply to products, there's this notion of what we've always had in companies, which I'll just call a core product team. That's the team that has always built the products, They're still absolutely critical. They're the ones that add more capabilities into the product so that it becomes more useful. And the challenge, though, is they will build something. They'll launch it. We'll see that, I don't know, in my experience, 70% of the time, 80% of the time, and I hope I'm not unique in this, the features don't have the kind of impact that we were hoping they would have. They do okay, but you know, it's like we were hoping for a lot more. But we still check it off the list because we launched it and we go to the next item in the roadmap. And then that thing we launched just sort of stagnates where it was because the logic is, well, at least it works a little bit. This other feature that's next on the roadmap doesn't exist at all. So we're going to add more value by at least launching that new one. So it's this heavy focus on launching things that have more value. That's what the core product team does. Where a growth product team comes in, or just growth in general, is, well, what about that feature that we launched that didn't live up to our expectations? How do we get more value out of it? And I try to differentiate between launches and landings. You know, if you're launching a rocket ship, great, that's the first part of it. But the other critical part is you've got to get it to land and get your astronauts back home safely. So we've launched all these features, but they haven't, you know, using this analogy, they haven't really, those features haven't landed with the end users. So they're just this potential value in the product. So where growth comes in is focusing on, for the most part, the vast majority is things we already have. How do we get them to land with our users? How do we get that value that's in the product into the actual hands of the users? So more people get more value from the product more often. So it's this launches versus landings thing. And with that in mind, the way you focus on that, on getting these features that actually land with users and get so they get more value out of it, the way to think about it is really growth is this iterative data-driven process of using what's essentially the scientific method to move a metric. So that's what the growth team focuses on. The core product team is about building new innovative features and understanding what the competitors are doing, what the users want, and so on. What the growth team is doing is starting with the data of what's delivering value, what isn't. And then using, when I refer to the scientific method, it's this notion of collecting data, coming up with a hypothesis that, you know, explains the data you just saw, and then coming up with an experiment based on your hypothesis to see if you can move those metrics. And so that's, you know, when I'm in a growth team, that's what I do all day. We analyze how people are using the product. We come up with a hypothesis about how we might be able to change that behavior. And then we run experiments, and success or failure is defined as, did we move that metric? So it's a very complementary function to the core product team. And in marketing, it's essentially the same thing. The marketing team launches campaigns and so on, and growth marketing will look at that and figure out, of the campaigns that are running right now, what can we do to really optimize their impact?
And how do you see this across various companies? So I see a lot of growth marketing teams once the team has scaled a little bit, maybe like a Series B, C onwards. I haven't personally seen too many product growth teams. What's been your observation? Like, people are doing it, not doing it, whether they should be actively considering if they're not doing it.
I think more people are doing it than you're probably aware of, and they certainly should be doing it because it's generally it's a much, much smaller team than the core product team if we're talking about just the product area. And the reason for that is 80% of you know what the feature needs if you launch something or more has already been built. But there's something that's holding it back from people getting value. It can be as simple as people don't even know the feature exists. You know, going back to like the Google search example, there were so many other things Google could do that people just didn't even know about. So the reason the teams can be very small but still have really like high impact is because a lot of the time it's not doing all the work to build out the feature. It's doing a little more work to make sure people know about it, that it's easy to find in the product. Or maybe there's something where they're getting confused. There's three steps that you go through to use a feature, and people are getting confused on the second step, and they're stopping and they're not completing, the actual function. So we can just look at that and go, we're seeing a 60% drop off after people get to the second step here of, setting up a dashboard or sharing a Miro board with colleagues or whatever it may be. So they're getting lost at that point. Let's take a look at what step two is and see if we can refine it and unlock the full value of the feature because people are just getting stuck at this little thing that's confusing on step two. Clarify that and we can get a huge value. It takes a much smaller team to do that, and the payoff from that team tends to be very high because, it's a little bit of work to unlock a huge amount of value.
Yeah, I guess the mental picture that I'm conjuring is like you've built a bridge, but you built like 90% of the bridge. So nobody can get across, even though most of the investment has happened.
Or even something like you've built a full bridge, but you don't have any lane markings. And it's a two-way bridge, and people are really getting confused as to, wait, how many lanes are there here? And people are reluctant to do it because it's dangerous. And so you'd come in and paint lane lines, right? Compare the cost of painting lane lines to the cost of building the bridge, but suddenly it just becomes easy and simple and straightforward to use that bridge, whereas before, you were taking your life in your hands if you wanted to try driving across it.
Makes sense. So, putting myself in the shoes of a startup founder, right? There's always so much demand for resources, and you're always struggling to figure out where to put it. And listening to you, it seems like a slam dunk to build a growth team if you found some reasonable PMF, even if you
Yeah,
don't feel
exactly. I
like
wouldn't do it
you're.
before you have PMF because then you're trying to grow the wrong thing.
Even after PMF, is it a slam dunk that everyone should have it? Or what would be the signals that will indicate that now is a good time to invest in growth?
I guess it depends on what your. Yes, I think everyone should have it. I think it's what it depends on is whether it's this full-blown team or whether there's a much smaller focus on it. I think in companies where it's a very complicated sale, it tends to be, and which would be more your enterprise products, of course, it tends to be the more complex the sale, the tougher challenge growth has. Because a lot of what you're trying to do in growth is use the product itself to help drive more engagement and nudge people to get more value out of it. But if it really is a very complex product, that becomes less successful. But even with that, I don't think growth is binary. It's not like either you're doing growth or you're not doing growth. Growth is really about how do we get more value out of the product into customers' hands by doing things that are highly scalable, doing things in the product itself, or doing things in marketing that will educate people when they're not in the product about things they can do in the product. The emails you get when you just sign up for a new product, those kinds of things. So even with very complicated products, you can always make the product a little more self-service. You can always reduce some friction in the buying process. You can always improve activation and engagement rates. So, a slam dunk, I don't think anything in business is a slam dunk, but anytime you've launched a feature that hasn't lived up to expectations, more than half the time, that's because it was your first attempt at that feature, not because people don't want the feature. It's because you didn't quite design it perfectly, and no one can design it perfectly every time the first time. So it's about just going back and refining things. And the reason I do think that everyone should be doing this, forget calling it growth. It's just about trying to drive your business by spending a significant amount of energy. Most people spend much closer to zero than anything significant on getting more value out of what's already there by driving growth, by focusing on the features you already have. It's the reason I always recommend that is because the reason that you built that feature first and the things that are on the roadmap next were not built first is because the thing you built first was you felt it was more important. That's why you built it first. So it's often super valuable to take something that was a more important, really core critical feature and get more value out of that than to add new features. I'm not saying it's one or the other. You clearly have to do both. But in most cases, people are focusing the overwhelming amount of their resources and time and energy on let's add more features and you become a feature factory versus what about all the features we deemed to be critical early on that, we still don't have as many people using them as we had expected. So that's why I think everyone should be focusing on it to some extent.
So I think the Google story is really interesting, but in some ways, it also feels like when you have that many users and that much data flowing in, it's kind of easy to find some hidden potential in there by just mining the data. What do you do when you're a small startup? How does growth play a role there?
I think there are things that there are several things that don't really change depending on the size. There are some things that do. But for example, every product, it doesn't matter what the size is, even if you have 200 users or 200 million users, if you're seeing that nobody is using, or not nobody, but you're getting much less engagement with this feature than you expected. And if you just launched, all the rage the last 2 years has been launching AI features, and you're seeing that it's just not getting the adoption you want. That's a growth problem for me. I would categorize it as, well, let's look at the data, figure out what's going on, and where are people using it, where are people not using it. If I have 200 users, I can do that analysis.
So I know you're consulting with a number of startups and there may be confidentiality and whatnot, but is there a story from a smaller scale that is interesting that you could talk about?
Yeah, I mean, let's see. There is smaller B2B company. Let me think of what would be a good example here. And what they are focusing on is providing software to corner stores, like your corner grocery store or the gas station store that sell a fraction, tiny subset of what a full grocery store would sell. And these tend to be mom and pop shops. And what this company does, the founder is he's just fantastic. His parents owned one of these mom and pop shops and they worked 7 days a week and everything there was focused on, doing everything on pencil and paper. So they help automate this so they can manage all your operations. For these corner stores. And so you can kind of get some of your life back, simplify things, and also get more profit. An exact example there, we saw that people weren't aware of the breadth. So you can go buy your inventory from this company and they will ship it to you, full service, and they'll manage logistics for you and so on. But you can go on and buy the inventory. And what they had found was, on average, people were buying 28 products from them per order. you know, it's the bread, the cheese, the Pepsis and Cokes, the snacks, whatever it may be, laundry detergent. So they were finding that these people were buying 28 products on average. So again, we're doing, you know, they have a few thousand stores that they work with. I think it's, you know, just a couple thousand. So, and there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these across the US. They were finding that this people were buying, in terms of what a store actually carries, a very small number. You know, they carry hundreds of products in these corner stores. And they were buying, you know, a few dozen from them. And again, a very similar analysis of they were buying candy. So they're really just using this company to keep them stocked on candy, or household cleaning goods. And so we just did this cross-sell thing. In fact, what we would do is when you would, they added this ability to see what prices are of these products that you're currently selling, in your zip code. What are other corner stores charging for these products? So giving you some pricing intelligence on that. We then started saying, oh, you know, would you like to see other high margin products where here's what people are charging for it, here's what we sell it for, so that could be a high margin for you that you're currently not selling. And we would introduce them to other categories, right? Either drinks or cleaning products or snack foods or you know, microwavable meals or whatever it is that you find in corner stores and gas stations. And it worked remarkably well. So this is a much, much smaller company. You know, they are fewer than 100 employees. And we did the same analysis to figure out people weren't even aware of the full set of products that they were offering that you could buy, and then they would manage inventory for you. So those types of things, just focusing on feature awareness, or in this case, in or product awareness, you know, catalog awareness, focusing on removing friction, it works on any size product.
That almost that reminds me of the Walmart story of apparently somebody did the analysis of all the receipts and figured out that beer and diaper gets bought together a
Yeah,
lot
that's
of
an old one,
time.
right? That people who it was the one of the spouses is coming home from work for the weekend, and the other one has said, oh, we need some diapers. And so they go to the corner store to pick up some diapers. And, you know, as long as they're there, they might as well pick up some beer. So, yeah, that was an old classic one. I don't actually know if it's true, but it's a great story regardless of the kind of analysis. But yeah, this was just simply doing the analysis of what are we seeing people are buying, and how do we just do better cross promotion of what we have, but that they're not buying, that they could be or should be, because here's some that are particularly high margin in your area because people are willing to pay a higher price in your area.
If so, a lot of these data and growth stories that I hear about often they become interesting when they're slightly counterintuitive, that like you wouldn't have expected that until you looked at data. What's the
Yeah.
most interesting counterintuitive growth story that you've come across?
Counterintuitive. Okay. Well, it was just surprising. We were running what was going on, where we saw it's just another Google example. And when if this is for Google Ads, so you know, one of their B2B products. So for Google Ads, when we would present your ad, historically, there had been your headline, which is like if you're a sporting goods store, it would be, you know, widest selection of sporting goods. And then you always had a subhead, which was, you know, lowest prices. So you had your head and your subhead. And we displayed them in the ad as head dash subhead. And we were just doing a little bit of minor tweaking, reformatting, making the boxes just a little bit cleaner and enlarging them just a little bit so we could increase the font a little bit. And we had done all of that already. And then somebody said, oh, one of the other things I wanted to do is, I think it's more modern to switch that hyphen to a vertical bar. So an absolutely trivial change. And when they did that, we noticed click-through rates went up significantly on ads. We're like, what? We weren't even trying to do anything here. Somebody just thought, oh, it's more modern to divide them with a vertical bar than just the hyphen, which makes it feel like it's all one thing. This makes it clearer that it's two things. And after they did some studies on what had actually happened, it turned out that our brains had become so attuned to seeing text hyphen text that we were starting to ignore ads that we were seeing. Anything that had the pattern of text hyphen text in a little box, we were ignoring. So referred to that as ad blindness. And just the simple change of making it text, vertical bar text, our brains re-registered it and we noticed it more. And that's why people clicked on it more. So the lesson there is that nudges or anything you're doing has a limited lifetime. So you have to keep changing things. Because that vertical bar, after a few months, now that became the norm. Now our brains started ignoring that again, and blindness set in again. So I think the issue there was any growth strategy that you have, whether it's using a new channel or anything like that, all of them have a limited lifespan. So you constantly have to be thinking up what else can we do because you have a limited amount of time that this is going to work. You have a limited amount of time to try and use whatever that is to the only thing that works forever, not forever. The only thing that works for a very long time is getting the user to create a habit of using the product. But these nudges only have a limited amount of time to help form that habit. And then we start ignoring them, even subconsciously. So I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, very interesting. That leads me to the next question I wanted to ask anyways, which is, in some ways, the work in growth is kind of like people in hedge fund trying to find alpha, right? The moment there's a limited window when you can exploit it, and after that it becomes common knowledge, and then there's no alpha left, and so you're constantly in search. So when you're working constantly on growth for a large enough company, how do you spot new opportunities? What's your process for spotting opportunities that are worth experimenting with?
There's, I think a lot of people for a long time, and I think this is a lot of where the term growth hacking came about, was it was this dark art. And you needed somebody who had done it before and they knew it worked and they knew all the tricks. And that's not it. First of all, because the tricks, as I just mentioned, only work for a little amount of time. And if somebody knows all these tricks and other people have used them, then using that trick in your app when it's already been used everywhere else won't work because people are already used to it. It doesn't catch their attention anymore. They don't notice it. The trick for all of this, if there is a trick, is to not use tricks. It's to use a process. And that's, you asked me before, what, how do I define growth? And I said it's an iterative, data-driven process of using the scientific method to move a metric. So we're always looking for the first thing you do is the for the scientific method is the analysis. And you're looking for something that has two qualities. The first quality is a milestone or a user experience in the app or some feature that they use that the usage of that or getting to that milestone or whatever it is highly correlated or at least somewhat correlated, if you can't find highly correlated with the outcomes you're looking for, generally engagement, retention, monetization. So the first thing is I want to find of all the features and things and experiences that my app has, stack rank them in terms of which ones are creating the most engagement and monetization or whatever metric I'm looking at. The second thing then is, and which ones of them have what I call headroom. If 90% of the people are already using that feature, There's not that much headroom. You can't really, getting the other 10% of people to use it isn't going to have a huge impact. Because you already have almost everybody using it. You're looking for something like one of the examples I used before, where only 15% of the people were using it. And like the sports score is one. Only 15% were using it, but those who used it, we were seeing good engagement and retention. So that met both requirements of what I'm looking for. So it's really just continually looking for those things using a fairly structured process. The thing where experience does help quite a bit is the second part. The first part is doing analysis. The second part is coming up with a hypothesis about how to change what we're seeing. And then the third part is running the experiment. The second part is where the creativity comes in. What do we think we can do to get more people to do this behavior that it will benefit them and therefore benefit us, that they're just not doing right now? I mean, growth is generally about how do we change user behaviors in a way that delivers more value to them in a way that therefore will then benefit us as a company. So it's really about if we can get people to follow that process, they will find the opportunities.
Very cool. So since I've started this new company and right now we are at seed stage, a lot of my questions are around small companies. So let's say that you're in pre-PMF stage. Should you be doing any of that? Should you be looking at any kind of data? If so, what kind of data? At what point should you start thinking about
Yeah. So
growth?
there's two things. One is the most important piece of data as a startup that you should be looking for is the data that tells you if you have PMF. And I don't know how you're looking at it right now, but for me, there are several ways, but the simplest and it's a pretty good first approximation of any of the other approaches, we'll give you a pretty similar example, is looking at your retention curves, where you start with a cohort of people who started using your product in a particular day or week or month, whatever the time unit is. And then you're looking, that's a fixed cohort of people, and no one ever is added to that cohort and no one is ever pulled out of that cohort. It's fixed. And then you're just looking every day, week, or month subsequent to that, what percentage of those people came back that day or week? And you're just plotting that. So by definition, the first day, it's 100% because they got into the cohort because they used the product that day. And they're new users. And you're just looking at, as time goes on, what percentage of them keep using it. And somebody can not use it for 2 weeks and then come back and use it again, and you count them on that day. But you'll see a curve that drops pretty steeply in almost all cases. You'll probably lose 70% of users, and maybe slightly less if it's a business app. Maybe you'll lose 50% in most business apps. There are some where you're required to use it by your company, so everybody's going to use it. But like, where you and I work together on an analytics app, it's not absolutely required that you use it, and you'll see that there's drop off in usage. And what you're looking for, though, and this is where the data becomes super important, is does that curve flatten? It's much less important where it flattens. Like, is it 10%? I 10% of that cohort now is coming back on a regular basis, or is it 30%? I care a lot less initially about where it flattens. What I do care about is does it flatten or does it keep going down and just crash into the x-axis pretty quickly? If it flattens, it means at least for that group of people, you have found product market fit. And now your task is how do I find two things. How do I find more people like them? And How do I find people who are adjacent to them, who my product is close, but not quite a fit for them yet? And now I can make more, add a few things to my product. So now it's a fit for them as well. But so, yeah, a growth team early on will really be focusing on, if you have a growth team, it's usually not a team, but person who's thinking about it, make sure you're able to track engagements and behaviors and so on.
Very interesting, because most people describe PMF as like the demand is outpacing supply that you can provide or something like that. But that's all about acquiring customers, not about retaining customers.
Yeah, no, that's if you were to ask me, what may be the most foundational rule for growth is, I would say it's that retention is more important than acquisition.
The
And
one of the reasons why people end up focusing on retention, on acquisition more than retention, is because it takes longer to figure out have you retained the user or not.
sort of, I mean that, well, technically that's true, but there's a great proxy which you can get information, insight into right away, which is engagement. Engagement is super highly correlated with retention, as you can imagine. They're two sides of the same coin, really. So I urge people to just look at engagement. Because it's pretty rare that a highly engaged person is not retained. Like they're not exactly the same thing, but as I mentioned, it's a really good proxy for retention. And engagement, I can measure every week. And so
Makes
that
a lot of sense.
gives you the answer there. And I think a lot of the reason people look at acquisition is you want to make a big splash and you want to get everybody using it, but you've all seen, or we've all seen, examples of these companies that so many people sign up and then almost as quickly they lose everyone. And that's worse than not getting a bunch of people to sign up initially. Because you've now lost those users. You've already put an impression in their mind that this product isn't something I find useful or valuable or entertaining or whatever it is. So now you're in a tougher situation of how do I resurrect this user who I've already lost? I have to change their mind. It would have been much, much better to do a much more controlled rollout, get a few people. So, yes, you have to do a small amount of acquisition to even see if you can retain them or engage them. See if you're getting engagement or retention. This is what we did at Zynga. We would launch a game, but only, we would kind of do an under the radar launch. No big marketing splashes, cross promos from other games. We didn't do that. We would make sure that the retention in the game had to be within, above a certain threshold. And if it wasn't, we wouldn't launch the game. We would either kill it, which happened occasionally, or back to the drawing boards, rework it, see if we can figure out what's wrong. But if then it did get over that retention threshold, that's when we would turn on the turbo boosters and apply marketing dollars and cross promote it from our other games and so on.
Do you think psychology plays a role here in the sense that quite often the retention curves are quite depressing?
For the firm, you mean, right? For the company that's the developer, yeah.
So it's a lot easier to focus on acquisition than retention, because it's much harder and
Retention is, well, retention is much, much harder. And it can be depressing. Okay, so yes, and what's your comments about that? Yes, it can be
I'm just
depressing.
asking, like, what do you observe in, like, as you're working with startups? That leads into the question that I was going to ask, which is, what are the most common traps that founders fall into when chasing growth, and how do you coach them out of it?
Yeah. We've already talked about one trap, which is it's all about acquisition. Growth, particularly for a more mature product, the more mature the product is, the more this is true. Your retention rates will be the limiting factor for your growth, not your acquisition rates. Because the retention rates tend to be a percentage of your current active user base. So as your user base grows, your churn, so the inverse is, if your retention rate, it's one minus retention. So your churn rate is going to grow as your user base grows. Acquisition, unless you've got really good virality, which is, we all know companies that have succeeded in doing that, but most don't get great virality. It's not a, it's not a viral product. Most don't have that. So, and in their case, acquisition is not related to the size of the user base. It's related to the size of the sales force or your marketing budget or whatever else it may be. So, if you don't do anything with, if you're not trying to, if you're not successful in improving retention, fairly soon, retention, the churn each month outstrips your acquisition. And at that point, you plateau. You can't get past that. And the way to get past that is I could keep trying to pour more and more leads into the top of this leaky funnel, or try and patch a few of the leaks. And so you'll find that as your company grows and so on, you'll probably be spending more time on retention and growing your existing customer base and not losing them. Because otherwise, your acquisition is really just replacing what you've lost, not actually growing.
So, what are some of the other things that
Some of
people
the other things that are
common traps
issues.
for founders?
Yeah, the other trap when it comes to growth for founders is that growth is a series of hacks, and we can juice things by doing something for a brief amount of time. And generally, those tend to be short-lived and not worth your time. The things that you really want to focus on is how do we, and this even comes down to choosing how are you going to measure growth? What are we focusing on? And you want to focus on some measure of value delivered to the user. So when I see people focusing on our North Star metric is number of new leads in the pipeline. For me, I think that's a terrible North Star metric. It has nothing to do with user value. But if you're an insurance company, a much better one would be something like if you're selling insurance software, it would be number or value or number of items insured on our platform, right? And as you get more customers, they'll insure more items through your platform. As you keep customers, that number grows. As you keep them longer, as you expand existing customers, that number grows. So it's focusing on to, the best way to drive growth is to focus on the user value, not a metric that you care about, but they could care less about. So it is true that your North Star metric needs to correlate with revenue. And in the example I just gave, if you sell insurance software, yes, it's not too much of a leap of faith to believe that as you start. Or as the number of items that you're insuring or the aggregate value of the insured items keeps going up, you should probably be making more money from that. That pretty good business model there. But as if you're just looking at new leads in the pipeline, that doesn't correlate to user value at all. And also wouldn't do things like, well, what about all my customers who are churning? Right? Whereas the first one, if I'm looking at total value of assets insured, churn pushes that number down. So I would see it in impact on my growth. So I think those are two of the things about startups. I think a more general thing And this is where data becomes really important to a startup, not particularly growth per se, but just data is on day one, make it really clear that the company values impact over effort. And this is, I led two companies as CEO. And I think that was when I finally learned that really helped a ton. And the next question was, well, what do you mean by impact? And I ended up defining it, and I still use it, this definition to this day, which is it's one of three things. It's changing a product, like because of something you did a product change, changing a process, or moving a metric. Moving a metric should be the vast majority of what you're thinking of when you talk about impact. You should be able to show. Now, I put the other two in there, changing a product or changing a process, because those can be impactful. They're often harder to measure what the in a metrics way, not impossible, but often can be quite hard to measure. But they're still valuable. But the majority should be moving metrics. Like, hey, we care about if you've done something. How do we know it had a good impact or a positive impact? And what that means is that implicitly requires that we are measuring and keeping data on these types of things. And so what that does also is as a startup, it's not we want to launch a dashboard so people can see the value that they're getting from our product. You want to rephrase it as what's the impact of that? And start with the problem of we're seeing churn because people are saying that they don't feel they're getting any value. And then our solution to that is we're going to create a dashboard that shows you the ROI of what you're getting. And but the success is not the launch of that dashboard. The success is what behavior do we believe we'll see change that we can measure. And it was what you said in the problem. We're seeing high churn, so the impact is lower churn. So that's a startup person should be thinking about how do we measure the progress we're making. So it's I'm very, very biased towards data and analytics, but just because I'm biased doesn't mean it's not incredibly valuable to do that from day one.
So this reminded me of the contradictory point of view that was popularized by Jeff Bezos' quote that I usually measure the input, not the output. And I can relate to that in one context, which is that if you want to encourage people to take risks and do risky things because the overall risk reward ratio is in your favor. If you're measuring the outcomes, it generally forces people to take fewer risks. And if you're saying that it's okay for you to take some risks, and even if the outcome doesn't come, I will not punish you for that. And in the long term, we would expect the input and output to align. But in the short term, I'm okay with you taking some risks and coming up empty. I used to see this when I used to work on machine learning at Google, that when systems people took a project, it would be very well defined, a lot of effort in the beginning and design doc and architecture review and everything. And then after that, when you build it, you more or less are guaranteed to have what you built work. And if there's few bugs to iron out and issues, you just go and fix those and then. Whereas on the AI side or machine learning side, it was all experiments, like we're going to do this and maybe it gives us a 2% boost in revenue, maybe it gives zero, but we're going to run 10 experiments and over a period of 1 year, at least three of those 10 experiments should result in something meaningful, and
That's
then that
right.
should.
So I think the fact that you should focus on impact, or my belief that you should focus on impact versus effort, that is kind of an underlying principle, but it's an underlying principle. It's not a universal law. So you have to have a balance. You have to be trying some big things that are going to be big swings. And this is where I always say, yes, we have numbers and we have a growth process, but we also still have managers, right? And managers are the ones who can figure out the gray areas, right? So it's like, yes, of course we need to balance with a couple big swings. And I know I'm asking you to do a big swing, and it's okay if it doesn't work. In fact, the only thing I say in terms of whether it's a big swing or a smaller experiment, the only time it's a real failure is if we didn't learn anything from it. Right? Even in smaller experiments, if it didn't move the needle the way we wanted it to, or what often happens, it moved it the wrong way. It's still an okay experiment. It wasn't a waste of time as long as we have a better insight into now what makes that metric move in one way or the other. And it just makes us more likely to be successful next time. But no, I wouldn't say that I would prioritize input over output. I'm in strongly in the camp that I would prioritize impact versus effort. But management has to come in and say we do need a balance. Right.
Makes
And
sense.
I don't want to celebrate the launch of a feature, for example. I want to celebrate that it had an impact.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So I know you advise a number of startups, and you have a consulting practice. Can you walk me through how do you work with a company of different sizes and scale? Like, what does day to day look like? How would you work with a company? And
Sure. What I do mostly with companies is depending on their stage, if it's early and it's pre-product market fit, what I'm working with them on is more the product itself and how do we get to product market fit. And the primary thing I focus on, which certainly isn't the only thing, but like one of the things I try to bring to the table, in addition to all the other things they need to do, is how are you differentiating your product? And that plays into several things. If you're a smaller product, there's always this notion of, well, our competitors do all these things, and a desire to then say, well, we can't compete if we don't do those things. And I think that's pretty fundamentally wrong. If you try and match them with at least a meaningful, subset of features, if you're in trying to get pretty close is what I mean, you're wasting your energy because they already got there first and they've had time to refine it. I would much rather, and I've seen much more success with, we don't have all that stuff, but we have that one thing that's different, and that's what will convince you to use our product. So focus on what makes you different and better. And I'll work with them. A little framework I use is the MUD framework, MUD. It ha the what you're focusing on, the difference has to be meaningful. It has to be fairly unique. So meaningful meaning they have to care about it, right? A difference that no one cares about is useless. And it has to be unique. Yes, there can be other people who do some of it, but in the grand scheme of things, it's pretty unique. And then defensible, meaning you can actually somewhat prove that you do this unique thing and others don't. Like a non-defensible differentiator is ours is easier to use. It's really, really hard to prove that it's easier to use. But if you're saying that, we can find you if we're in healthcare and we can save you 10% of your spend on medications, right? And which is twice what anyone else can. You can defend that. You can show the data. So the first thing is, what is going to be your differentiator? And your initial roadmap should focus heavily on that. And leave the things that your competitors have, the only thing, to the wayside. The only caveat there is there are some things that if you leave them out, then the product just isn't even usable. But you can leave out all of these other things and focus on what makes you different. Then the second thing is you want to make sure that as the user gets into the product, the onboarding process doesn't teach them about the product. It gets them to quickly experience the product's differentiator. So those are the things that I'll work on early with a customer. And then as they start getting to product market fit, then we'll start focusing on, great, what's working, what's not working, and we will start instrumenting more of the product if it hasn't already been done. And then my goal is focusing on how do we apply this growth process, the analysis, come up with a hypothesis, then run experiments and make product changes and so on. How do we put that into the product team? And then how do we have the rest of the company also get involved? Because growth ultimately is a team sport. It's not just something the product team does. Marketing has to focus on particular messaging that is highlighting the differentiators that right when we get into the product, we're getting people to those differentiators, and the growth team is focusing on how do we make sure that as many people as possible successfully experience the differentiators as quickly as possible. So the whole company overall gets involved.
So let's say I'm a startup founder. I am thinking about growth. What should I do? Obviously, come to you for
No, I
help,
mean,
but
hey, I'm always happy to chat with anyone. But there's plenty you should do out there. I mean, I think there's plenty of what you can learn about out there already. And I think it may be nice to have someone who has been through it before who you can chat with about it. But I certainly hope it's not a requirement, because otherwise the whole concept of growth, there's just not enough people who do what I do, that if you had to work with us, the industry would just die. So I think there's plenty of things out there. The main thing that you want to focus on is thinking about it just as a process. I want to think about what happens after I release something. How do I go back and keep optimizing to get the most value out of it? And it's not all about the big home runs. I think growth, ultimately, the companies that have been most successful in growth, think about growth as a game of inches, where it's a lot of little things. But so if you want to get started in growth, learn about the processes. They're not, it's the scientific method, right? Everybody learned about it in elementary school. Learn about that. And the other thing that you need to do to get started with growth is make sure you're focusing on data. Instrument your app, instrument your marketing channels, and try and get as clean data as possible. The more data you have and the cleaner it is, the easier it will make your life. But honestly, you can work with whatever data you currently have. So it's not that
And
hard to get started. You don't need always to go hire someone to do it initially. If it starts taking off and you really want to expand it and really refine it, then either hire someone or work with an advisor, whatever it may be.
are there books or blogs or podcasts that you would recommend for this
Yeah, I
purpose?
think my favorite is Lenny's podcast. And it's called Lenny's Podcast, Lenny Rachitsky. He's got by far the most successful one out there. One of the things I recommend to people is I'm not sure how long it's been out. It's a few years. Go back to his old catalog, where he had some, that was in the days when he was just talking about, the basics. Now he gets into there's some notion of, well, you already know the basics, so now we get into other topics really deeply, which is really valuable. But for somebody getting started, the back catalog, just go through, read the titles, and the ones that catch your interest, just listen to them. You
That
will
reminds
learn a
me.
ton.
That reminds me, you had published on his blog your ARIA framework, right? Do you want to
Yeah,
take a quick minute to talk about that?
sure. I did publish an article in he also has a newsletter, and so I wrote a guest post for his newsletter a year and a half ago, something like that. And the title of it was, you'll hear as a repeating theme of things I've already said, how to drive growth by focusing on the features you already have. And then the subtitle was Introducing the ARIA Framework, and it's ARIA, which is another way of how you can get, started with growth. It's a pretty simple framework. The A is analysis. So start by doing analysis, and it talks about the thing I'd already mentioned. Find those features or experiences that are correlated with retention where there's headroom, where not everybody is already using it. The R is reduce, which is about reducing the friction. So many times we have something in our product, but people are getting stuck. It has too many steps. They don't understand a step. It can be the physical friction of doing the action. It can be the cognitive friction of signing up for some fintech service, and I have to give you my bank account information. That's kind of cognitive friction because, well, do I want to do this? I mean, it's not hard to do, but how do we make that easier for you? So it's reducing the friction. Somehow, how can we make you trust for that specific example of entering your bank account information? How do we make it so you're worried less? That's the reduce part, reduce the steps in a process, reduce the friction in each step. The I part in ARIA is introduce, which also brings back some of the things that I've been talking about, where a lot of people just don't know what your product can do. So, it's introducing the features. And it's not just introducing features that have a lot of value, but a lot of overhead too, because not everybody's using it. It's not just about a pop-up of, hey, there's this new feature. It's introducing the features at the right time. Something that I refer to as introducing the feature in context, meaning at a time when if I introduce something to you, it's at a time when you're more likely to use it than, or you're there's some likelihood you would want to use it at that time. If you open an app and in your browser or on your phone, and it comes up with a splash screen about some feature you haven't used, generally that gets dismissed, completely ignored. You didn't read it. It had no impact. And I've done three or so different studies where we showed that it essentially has no impact whatsoever. When you survey people a week later, they have zero recollection of what it said in that pop-up because they weren't there to do that specific thing. But an example of introducing something in context is back in my days at Google, the consumer app, Google Maps, we wanted to introduce this concept of a pit stop. Which is if you're navigating from point A to point B, you could find food, gas stations, restrooms along the route that you're currently navigating. And so it would avoid doing things like, oh, the closest one is 2 miles behind you. Like, no, I'd rather go 4 miles ahead than 2 miles back. So that was the feature. And we did launch it with a pop-up initially, and just nobody noticed it, nobody used it. So the obvious in context time to use it there was we would wait until you would navigate from a point A to point B, that you're actually using it to navigate. And if the navigation was something like, I don't remember the details, but if it was going to be more than 2 hours, we'd say, hey, would you like to add a pit stop for food, restroom, gas? Now that's a time when somebody's like, yeah, that's actually useful. I might want to use that right now. And if they use it, now they remember it because they've taken the action. So that's the introduce. And then the last part is assist, which is how do I make just using the app easier by assisting, and I don't mean help, although that, help text, although you should certainly have that. It's things like providing templates. So I don't need to be as much of an expert to use the product. That's really what it gets down to, that if your product has a learning curve, how do I smooth out that learning curve, right? When you're using Miro, they have hundreds and hundreds of templates that help get you started, and Canva. It's, well, what if you're not an artist, which most people use Canva aren't artists. They can help you by making something really interesting. Or in Google Photos, they make a fair bit of money by selling you photo albums, the physical kind of coffee table photo albums. Well, it can be a lot of work making the album. So what they do when you go there is they've already pre-made some for you. And the notion is you can go in and edit it versus starting from scratch. Right? They're like, oh, here's one for your pet. Here's one from a trip you took to Paris. And you can go in and it's much easier because you've helped me. You've done a nice layout. I can go in and tweak it, which is much, much easier than asking me to start from scratch.
Very cool. Thank you so much. I always learned so much by talking to you.
Well, the feeling is mutual. I remember, we had many lunches and many conversations where I picked your brain. So you've been a great influence on me.
So now I want to switch to a few fun questions that I like to ask.
Okay.
So say that you're forced into giving a TED talk, which cannot be about what people already know you for. Like it cannot be about growth, or analytics. What would that be?
Okay. My TED talk would be about how to grow up while remaining childlike.
Oh, I love
That's
that.
what I would give a TED talk on. I've never thought of that before until now. But I think one of the things I've really tried to do, and when you ask that question, I'm like, what other people know me for? And I'm sure some people call me childish, but hopefully more people would say he has like a childlike attitude towards him. And I think it's just looking for the fun and the wonder in things and how to just do that consciously. And so I try and figure out how can I bring a little amount of just joy or laughter to people every day. And there's a couple that, over a few decades of thinking about, that's what I like doing, that's how I like being. I think I've got a couple of things. I could put together an interesting TED talk. That's a great question. How to grow up while still remaining childlike.
Give me one thing from that talk, because I would love to have more of that in my life.
One is don't be afraid to embarrass yourself, right? Do silly, stupid things, and if it becomes something that was a little sillier and a lot more stupid than you thought it was going to be, like, okay, well, yes, but a couple times it'll just be something that was so much fun that you never thought, right? Like use the water slide at a kiddie pool, right? Because it's just silly and fun to use, right? And also try new things that might scare you, because when you're a kid, every new thing kind of scares you. And I think we get a little too settled into patterns and behaviors in our comfort zone. So I remember one of the things, because of the kind of this little philosophy that I have, I was terrified of skydiving. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to really be a skydiver. It's I wanted to do something that scared me because I didn't like being held back. Like kids will go out and just try things and they'll skin their knee and so on and they learn from it. Adults tend to do that a lot less. Now, I didn't want to skin my knee in a catastrophic way while skydiving and have something fail on me, but that's why I was nervous about it. And I'm like, no. I want to just try it and see what it's like. Because I think, kids try lots of things. So there's two things. I'd have to think of more for a TED talk, but maybe that's my style.
All right. Second question. And I'm stealing these questions from another podcast. So all of us were a little awkward growing up as, kids or teenagers. And some of that awkwardness often turns into a superpower as you become an adult. In fact, when somebody asks me this question, my answer is usually my ability to embarrass myself and do embarrassing things. What was something that made you awkward growing up, but is a superpower for you now?
I ask a lot of questions, and I sometimes, well, growing up, I used to drive my mother nuts. She's like, you just are incessant with these questions. And with friends, they used to always think that I was grilling them and testing them. And I'm like, no, I was just trying to learn. I think that has become a good superpower of mine now that, well, now I can ask questions online to Google and ChatGPT and so on. But I think because I do ask so many questions, about like just random things. And I'll hear an expression like, oh, what's the history of that expression? I think I've ended up learning about a lot of things that are outside of what I do day to day, but can still help, they all help you think more broadly about everything, and therefore can help you think more broadly about the thing you focus on every day.
Very cool.
There are churches in Norway that are made out of wood, and they're some of the oldest remaining, and many of them are like this, some of the oldest remaining wooden structures in history. I'm like, what did they do to make those churches and those wooden structures last so much longer than any other wooden structures? And sure enough, there's more than one video on YouTube about that exactly. So I'll end up watching it. So yeah, it's asking questions, and it went from being really annoying where no one would want to be around me too long to now I think it's a superpower.
And what's the most non-obvious thing that you're grateful for? Like, all of us are grateful for health, family, the careers that we've had, but what would be something that's a little unobvious?
I am very grateful for the time my family overruled me about getting a dog. I grew up with a dog, kind of love dogs, but we had three young kids in the house, and they're like, we want a dog. And I'm like, this is gonna be it. We have enough chaos. We have enough living creatures in the house right now, and it's enough chaos. And the thought of it physically got me anxious. And there was even a time when the family said, can we just go to like a pet store and just look around? And my wife will tell the story about how I started sweating while I was in there. I was just so anxious about it. Felt like, oh my God, I have three kids. We're now going to have a fourth kid. And I don't think I can handle that. So I said, I don't, we're just not going to do it. So, and I really put my foot down, and it shows how much authority I have because they just came in one day and said, you have a puppy now. And I was so stressed and upset, and now it is the greatest thing. I can't imagine not having a dog in my life. So I am just grateful for people who have not listened to me.
Love that. All right. Last two questions.
Sure.
Favorite book that you'd recommend everyone read, or you'd gift it to people that are close to you?
My favorite book is a book by Dan Ariely, called Predictably Irrational. And I just love it. The stories in there are fascinating, but it's basically a pretty foundational book on behavioral science. And it's a super easy read. It's a fun read about it's basically all these quirky things we do that are completely irrational. When we're making decisions about things, how we decide things so irrationally, but we do it in a highly predict we do it every time. It's highly predictable. And I just, for anyone working on products, having that kind of understanding of this is universal, I think is super helpful. And even if you have nothing to do with products, it's just a fascinating insight into what goes on in our heads when we have to make decisions. So I
Fantastic.
probably that one.
All right. Awesome. And last question. What in the last few years have you tweaked that has made the most positive impact in your life?
What have I tweaked that
Yeah,
has made
or
the
like
most
any
positive?
lifestyle change or
Yes.
purchase or anything like that?
Yes. One you may not hear all that often. It's not sleep or exercise or eating better. Posture, a serious focus on posture. And I went to a woman who is kind of this renowned posture specialist, and I went there for many, many months. I was like, just stand up straight. How hard is it? But I had some back challenges, and it was just affecting a lot of things. And I have different chairs now that I use. I changed my mattress so I now sleep on my back because it's better for my spine and so on. But that I used to have this constant nagging sensation in the back of my head that my back doesn't feel great. And so just focusing on posture. I'm not sure if that's a good one or not. Another one, and you can choose or use them both, is not listening to podcasts in my car, and instead listening to music. Like, I talk to business people all day long, and I realized now I'm listening to business people in my car, talk about something or news or whatever the podcast is. And I felt like I grew up loving music. And so really the change I made was I don't really listen to many podcasts anymore. I th certainly think they're valuable, but for me, I felt like I had to listen to the next one and it was causing me more stress than enjoyment. And like, oh, I'm three behind now. They've put out three and I haven't heard them. I got to find the time to listen to them. And I'm like, you know what? I'm fine without them. I loved them, but I'm fine without them. And now I'm back to music, and it's wonderful.
And now I have to ask you one more question that I
Oh,
didn't plan
no.
on. Which artist or musician would you introduce someone to that
Oh, my
you
favorite
love?
of all time, and I do have one, is Peter Gabriel. Through decades, he has been an innovator in music, different musical styles. He's a great lyricist. He's been politically, he's sort of a political activist as well through his music. And he's just brilliantly talented, and he's played with different bands, great solo career, but I have seen him probably in concert a dozen times, and each time it's quite different. And I think he's brilliant. And if there was only one artist that I could take to my proverbial desert island, That would be the set of albums I would take, his whole catalog.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Ken. It's such a pleasure talking to you.
Always,
This.
always great talking to you on it. So, yeah, I again, thank you for having me on the show. This has been fun for me just to get to think about the questions you ask and what I've learned in those areas. And it really helped me solidify a lot of my thinking too about like, okay, that's a good question he just asked. And so when people ask me questions, I always learn.
Yeah, very cool. All right. Well, that will wrap it up. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.